हरे कृष्ण महाराज, हम्बल ओबेसेंसेस।
चैतन्य चरण प्रभु
थैंक यू वेरी मच फॉर ज्वाइनिंग वंस अगेन। इट हैज बीन अ जॉय टू हैव यू, एंड मेनी ऑफ आवर व्यूअर्स हैव अप्रिशिएटेड लास्ट टाइम्स पॉडकास्ट। दिस इज वेरी डीप डिटेल्ड डिस्कशन विथ क्वाइट अ फ्यू प्रैक्टिकल पॉइंटर्स, एंड स्पेशली द कॉमन कमेंट वॉज दैट अपार्ट फ्रॉम वॉट केम बिलो यूट्यूब ऑल्सो इज वॉट आई गॉट इज दैट वी नेवर get to hear a subject in so much detail in normal classes or in normal forums. So I think that I'm grateful that you're sparing so much of your time. So
It's a pleasure, Chaitanya Charan Prabhu, to be on this podcast and have some very nice and deep, engaging discussions on various topics that are of great relevance to everyone in the modern age.
yes, thank you. So that's our purpose. So today I thought that based on the theme we discussed last time of veganism and bhakti, we could take it forward to a related and broader theme of environmentalism and bhakti. And we could more or less follow the same structure that we could talk about how environmentalism has risen, and then how there are areas where it overlaps with bhakti, and where the areas where it diverges, how those areas can be dealt with. So will that be okay?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So now the environmental movement broadly has three aspects to it in terms of the historical or in terms of origin. One is the practical consequences of the environment which started it. Then the intellectual understanding of why it has happened and what can be done. And then the practical measures that can be taken for dealing with it. So that means what is happening, why did it happen, and what can be done about it. So now what is happening? It seems from the 1960s, 70s onwards, slowly this awareness started rising that our rampant industrialization is having a lot of counterproductive consequences. It was broadly till more or less the First World War or even the Second World War, much of modernity had a very starry-eyed view of the effects of science, technology, and the results of that for society. But the Second World War, and especially the use of the atom bombs, that began the erosion of the belief that science and technology will be the source of unmitigated good for humanity, of unquestionable good. Because Einstein was considered to be probably the greatest scientific brain of the last century. And his greatest scientific insight, that E is equal to mc square, led to the greatest man-made disaster in terms of the weapon of mass destruction actually being used on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So from that time onward, the skepticism went on. The skepticism was also intellectual in terms of philosophy of science, philosophers of science questioning how reliable is science as a source of knowledge. Karl Popper and others, they pointed out some problems. So now, when the industrialization was going on, and when we were expanding our humanity was expanding its reach, there was just one definition of progress, more or less, that the more industrialized the society is, the more technology that we use, the more we push back into the world, we expand humanity's reach, the more successful we are and the happier we will be. But the Silent Spring was among the first books that brought the environmental hazards into public consciousness. And thereafter, more and more things have become evident, and especially over a period of time, as originally what was called was global warming, that the temperature is increasing, and there were several predictions of almost environmental, of the earth destruction. But then now the idea has been broadened that it's not just global warming, but it's climate change. And it has, so global warming was one aspect that the oceans will overflow, but now it is broader that there are many aspects to it and they need to be addressed. So this is my broad understanding of historically how skepticism about industrialization and its consequences, especially in terms of environmental consequences, came about. You'd like to
say? Well, environmentalism, as I see it, is a response, as you also indicated, that because there were very visible, tangible consequences that humanity started experiencing in the last many decades. So gradually there emerged a response. And as the consequences became more and more harmful and more visible, more and more undeniable, the more the questioning of the underlying, shall we say, practices and philosophies that fueled that kind of situation began to rise. And ultimately then, environmentalism rose as a protest, as a response, as an act of concern. Because after all, what is environmentalism? It's a kind of an activism.
Yeah.
You know, there are activists of different sorts. You know, you have activists in various social areas or scientific areas. So you have people who are very concerned about the way things were going on the planet. And they did not want to see this destruction and this harm being continued. So there was a kind of an alarm that was raised in the minds of people. Okay, if we let the situation persist, then it's not going to be a pleasant scenario at all. It's only going downhill. So environmentalism actually rose as a symptom. It was a response to things that were seen.
Yeah.
Of course, should I come to the second question? Your first was what? What are the what is or what are the effects?
Yes, I think.
And the intellectual questioning of it.
Yes, we'll focus on the second part, I think. Yeah, okay. You can come to the second part.
So, I think that, you know, whenever we speak of a symptom of something or a response to something, one must examine the underlying causes.
Yes.
Otherwise, one will never be able to do the third thing that you said, which is to find a remedy or a solution, yes, or even to understand what's going on. So because environmentalism is a kind of activism, it's a kind of response, it's a kind of a concern and action-based kind of field, we must see it in relation to what led to this whole thing, not just the consequences. But there were underlying philosophies and events that happened in recent human history. So I would say there were basically one thing that sparked it all off was the rise of modern industrialization, specifically the Industrial Revolution. I think what the Industrial Revolution did was that it gave man or humanity, let us say, a kind of a false belief in the power that it could wield. And it gave a kind of a, it deluded man into thinking that humanity could control and manipulate nature at will for maximizing the pleasures and comforts and fulfill all the desires of the human race.
Mm.
And what industrialization led to is also kind of belief that humanity did not need anybody else or anything else apart from its own intellectual prowess and its own technological might.
Mm.
So because of that, there were other issues that came up. Number one, we omitted, we neglected to see the complex and sublime interrelationships that existed between the living organisms and entities in this world amongst each other and with the environment. And second of all, it also gave rise to a feeling of power that we can do it on our own. And that also probably set the tone for various kinds of atheistic thinkers in the physical as well as the social sciences, physical, biological, and social sciences. So I would say the 19th century was the turning point, although it had been building up for a while from before, when you had the Industrial Revolution starting, and then you had some very powerful thinkers who came along, specifically Karl Marx, who advocated a theory of social and economic, shall we say, well-being. Because he had a certain formula, an analysis of a diagnosis of what was wrong with the world socially and economically. And he wanted to remedy that based on his understanding. So Karl Marx became very, very influential. Until today, his thinking is very influential, even though there are very few countries that are communist. China, maybe Cuba, maybe a couple of Latin American countries, but it's not there. But you have such influence of the Marxist ideology, neo-Marxism and so on, that is heavily influencing the thinkers of today, the academia in particular, and maybe the liberal thinking of today. And then also came thinkers like Charles Darwin, who then inaugurated a kind of an atheistic science. Earlier also, there were scientists who were somewhat atheistic. But previous to that, largely in the previous few centuries, given few exceptions, by and large, the scientists in Europe who really inaugurated modern science, so to speak, modern science as we understand it today, they were theistic. They believed in God. But from Charles Darwin, there was a turning point.
Yes.
But then you had these two things together. You had the Industrial Revolution on one hand that gave technological might and changed the mindset of people in a certain way. And then you had these powerful thinkers coming along who became very, very influential. And then as the 20th century began, and then there was a great explosion in modern physical sciences, specifically physics and to some degree chemistry. And then that perhaps in the minds of many people also strengthened the idea of atheism. And as the 20th century progressed, by the time we had reached the mid-20th century, and maybe a few decades later, atheism was very strongly entrenched. So these two things combined, power and a sense of intellectual pride that I can figure out the world myself with my science and we've got all these theories. So it kind of led human beings to go down a road which was self-destructive. And it was only a few sensitive scientists who actually probed deep into this and started self-questioning. you mentioned the name of Einstein, that he also started thinking. You also mentioned Karl Popper.
Yeah.
Yes, Karl Popper was, of course, a great philosopher of science.
Yes.
And he started examining the processes and the philosophy of science and what it had brought to humanity.
Yes.
So I think because of this, the consequences of everything, the technology, the industry, the science, the hubris of humanity, it all came together. And then before we realized it, the devastation or the damage was quite enormous.
Yes.
And I think that is when slowly the environmentalism movement began.
Thank you, Maharaj. This is quite a cogent analysis. In preparation for this talk, I had a discussion with a friend who studies environmental ethics. He's doing his PhD in that. So he sent me a link on the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy of environmentalism. And it's fascinating how they have, the mainstream environmental researchers and environmental thinkers have seen these developments as having a significantly different cause. Rather than atheism being responsible, they hold Christianity to be responsible. Rather than industrialization to be responsible, they hold capitalism to be responsible. And there is a utilitarian approach towards religion that is being slowly, grudgingly admitted. So basically what happened is that the idea is, why are we humanly exploiting nature? The other idea is technology, industrialization, these are true, but that is simply a tool. Somehow, I haven't seen anyone, at least in the mainstream environmental research, holding science and the consequence of science as responsible for this. What it is, there I said that Christianity was existing in the Western world, and last time we discussed about anthropocentrism. So, because of the Christian worldview that humans are special and we have dominion over nature, so that gave us the entitlement mentality by which we exploited nature. And there are the specific historical trajectories, and there are different for this, but that anthropocentrism, so not so much materialism or atheism, but anthropocentrism is seen as the primary cause. And in fact, Marx, in his own way, he condemned industries, not so much industrialization. His idea was that in the way industries work, workers are exploited and they have to do work which doesn't allow them any creativity. Now, and he felt that there has to be a more fulfilling kind of work. So his critique was against capitalism. And if we even see today, the idea is, if we have environmentalists who are say, there is a Green New Deal being proposed in America, which is involving radical measures for restructuring the economy, but there is not much accommodation of anything spiritual in it. The idea is humanity is the problem and humanity needs to be curbed. So what has happened, at least now, as a reaction to this, like environmentalism has become a very leftist movement in many ways. And those who are on the right, they feel that this environmental movement has become a tool for the leftist liberals to grab power and control us, control what vehicles we use, what planes we use. And there has been a significant, not overwhelming, but a significant resistance to the environmental movement. So it has become quite politicalized. And it's not so, at least in the mainstream, there is a utilitarian acknowledgement of the role of religion, that just by telling people that take care of the environment, it doesn't work. So they say we need a cultural transformation or a spiritual transformation. And if people can find more non-material enrichment, then they will stop the rampant consumption of goods, which is fueling the degradation of the environment. So in that sense, curbing humanity's expansionist reach by various political, social measures, including incorporating religion. But many of those who even say that nature should be infused with the view of the sacred, they are themselves quite atheist. But they such a vision that nature is sacred, that might help for people to respect nature more. So in some ways, while it is leftist, there is a significant openness to Eastern spirituality, because Eastern spirituality often is seen to be more to be having also an immanent vision of divinity, that even nature is sacred. So now Buddhism has actually presented itself much more than the Vedic path in terms of how it can be environmental friendly. But that's just the mainstream intellectual trends that are there.
Yeah. You made a lot of points. Excuse me. Let me see if I can recall the main points, because there's quite a few important points there. Now, you mentioned that environmentalism has become a largely leftist-oriented kind of a movement. And that is not surprising, because any kind of activism is usually politically oriented. And by definition, environmentalism is a kind of a political and social movement that is born out of a concern for the protection and the conservation of the environment. I want to distinguish that from ecology, and that's a very important distinction that I want to make later as we go down. Okay. So yes, definitely it is a politically connected or oriented kind of a movement. Now, coming to the causes for the rise of environmentalism, I would definitely grant that there are many reasons for it. Let's examine some of the things that you mentioned, that your friend said, which is a thinking in the academic circles nowadays. The academics or many thinkers today lay the blame for environmental degradation and misuse of industries and so on at the feet of Christian theology. Because Christian theology, they say, is essentially anthropocentric.
Yeah.
Which places humanity at the center of the earth, and it gives human beings a sense of entitlement that they are the monarchs of the earth, and the entire environment is at their disposal to enjoy. Now, to some degree, I would say it is true that Christianity is indeed anthropocentric. For example, from the Vedic point of view, as follows of the Bhagavad Gita, we accept that the soul that exists in all living entities, in all life forms, including trees and animals, insects. But many Christian theologians don't accept that animals have souls.
Yes, that's true.
Right? So in that sense, this is just one example of how the allegation that is made against the Christian theology that it is anthropocentric and therefore could have a role to play in environmental problems, it has some merit. At the same time, I also want to point out that Christianity has existed for 2,000 years. Why have we not seen the kind of scale of environmental degradation and the other problems that happened prior to the Industrial Revolution coming in?
Yeah, we didn't have the tools.
We didn't have the tools. So undoubtedly, it is a mindset of human beings that drives anything. Because any action has to have an underlying thought process. So the thought process is not an exclusive, this thought process is not the exclusive preserve of Christian theology, to be fair to them. It's essentially a materialistic thought process that we want to enjoy this world.
Okay.
Any religion, or be someone ascribing, subscribing to any religion, or being an atheist or whatever. So therefore, the entire gamut of philosophies that espoused a philosophy that focused on giving primacy to the human enjoying spirit and to the position of humans here is also responsible. But now, after science and technology came to the fore, modern science and technology, then man had the tools. Science and technology gave power. And power has to be exercised very responsibly. It requires great intelligence, great wisdom to be able to exercise power. And without that wisdom, which comes from some higher spiritual source, it is very hard to be able to utilize or wield power very benevolently. Then, in the absence of a benevolent mindset or a philosophy that guides people, then rather it gets to be used malevolently. So even though Christianity does speak about a theology and there is, you know, service to God, but because of this particular issue of anthropocentrism, there is a problem here. But this problem also exists with many other materialistic philosophies and perhaps some other theologies, I don't know. And this is where I want to bring in the point of ecology. It is a well-known fact amongst those who study these two subjects in academia that there is a distinction between environmentalism and ecology. Environmentalism, as I mentioned earlier, is a kind of an activism.
Yeah.
Born out of a concern for protection and conservation of the environment. Whereas ecology is a kind of a study, very interesting. It's a study of the interrelationships between living organisms amongst each other, and also between living organisms and the inanimate environment. So ecology is a science of relationships. It's very, very complex. And there are cycles, there are flows of energy, there are nutrient cycles of, you know, if you study biology or ecology or, you know, things like that, then we have all these cycles, right? Of how energy flows, you know, water evaporates from the seas, goes into the clouds, it comes back, goes into the soil. There's a water cycle and there's a photosynthesis and how the sun's energy is transformed. So this is ecology in a sense that it speaks about relationships. Now, where the underlying philosophies that drove the exploitative spirit have what they have in common is that they don't have a holistic, a wholesome understanding of ecology. So therefore, I would say bhakti ecology is a better way to put it than bhakti environmentalism, because a devotee of the Lord sees the relationships, you know, of the world. Now I'll come to the other point that you mentioned. We'll talk about ecology and the thing a little later if the opportunity arises. But you also mentioned an interesting point. Some people say that nature itself is sacred. Yes?
At least we should infuse a vision of the sacred into our conception of nature so that it will be respected and protected.
Yes, and ironically, some of these people are atheists themselves.
Yes.
Okay. So here, probably these are what were called in the 70s and 80s, I don't know what it is today, deep ecologists.
Yes.
Deep ecologists are those who try to, you know, see that man has a certain humble place, a position in the scheme of things in nature, on the earth. Man isn't anything very special. There is no exceptionalism there. So the kind of vision probably extended a little further would mean that they try to see nature itself as sacred. But they may not understand the spiritual nature of living entities, that we are the spirit soul. And they don't accept that there is ultimately another superior force that is controlling everything. So we see that such thinkers who consider the earth as an entire ecosystem, which it is indeed, although the earth also has many sub-ecosystems, but these sub-ecosystems also interrelate with each other in a beautiful way for harmonious coexistence. What the deep ecologists and similar kinds of thinkers stop there. Whereas we as bhakti ecologists, as devotees of Lord Krishna, we do not see the earth as an isolated ecosystem. And actually, even from a modern scientific point of view, the earth is not an independent ecosystem because we depend on sunlight. Just imagine if there was no sunlight even for a few hours, what would happen to the whole earth planet? So even apart from the sun and the rest of the universe, we're talking of a supreme intelligence, a supreme power, God, we call him Krishna, under whose superintendence and direction this whole ecosystem is going on. This massive ecosystem, yes, which is in itself perfect. And the perfection lies, our perfection lies in seeing the intrinsic perfection of each ecosystem within itself, but we also must see the interrelationship of each ecosystem with the other, and overall the relationship of the massive earth ecosystem and the universal ecosystem with the ultimate source of all of them, which is Krishna. So because we lack that in the general world of environmentalism and modern thinking, so there is a great missing point. If you remember last time when we spoke about veganism, I mentioned a point that environmentalists speak about Mother Nature. They want to conserve Mother Nature. And I said that what's missing is an understanding of Father God.
Yes.
So that is what completes the ecosystem. So when you consider understand Krishna as the father of all living entities, as the source of everything animate and inanimate, then you have a complete ecosystem.
Okay.
And if you leave Krishna out of the picture, you leave God out of the picture, your ecosystem is incomplete. Because the very root, the very origin, and the very source of sustenance and interdependence of all these complex ecosystems is neglected. Therefore, I think where environmentalism has a drawback is that it doesn't take into account this thing. And even though Christianity believe in a supreme God who has created, they see it from the point of view of human exceptionalism.
Yes.
They do not see everything else as sacred. So this, therefore, coming back to your point, to blame, although Christianity may have a role to play, but I would not, to be fair to Christianity, blame it entirely. It is essentially materialism. It is lack of an understanding of our own spiritual nature as spirit souls. It is a lack of understanding and faith and belief in a supreme source of everything. It is a lack of understanding of the divinity of the entire creation. There are two reasons why, principally, we believe as follows of the Bhagavad Gita, that nature is divine. Because it comes from the divine. It is the energy of the divine. We don't accept nature as God, but we accept nature as godly. Because it comes from God. It is the energy of God. And that connection is very important. And the second reason is that God is immanent in this creation, in the sense that he is all-pervasively present.
Yes.
Not only is he present in every, in the heart of every living being, as the Bhagavad Gita says, but he's also present in every atom. Therefore, every atom is sacred from that point of view. So, we see the divinity of nature in this respect. It is not a sentimental or a utilitarian kind of premise for accepting nature as sacred or divine.
Yes, Maharaj. So, now, there are opportunities for bhakti theology to act as a spiritual foundation for environmental concerns. Right now, environmental concerns are genuine, but I would say that there is no proper worldview within which to ground them. So bhakti theology could work for that. Now, one of the objections that I have seen is that in principle, we may say that the world is sacred and nature is sacred, but is this seen through our actions? That means that do we see, say, for example, in India or any other parts of the world, that because of our spirituality, because of our understanding of nature, we have taken special care of nature? Now, if we look at our epics, there are descriptions of destruction of nature. Say, the Pandavas burned the Khandava forest. The Hanuman destroys the Ashok Vatika. Then when the Vanaras come back after searching for Sita and they're celebrating, they disrupt the gardens of Sugriva. Then even there are descriptions of how when some warriors are fighting, they just pick up trees and hurl and destroy trees. So now that's one side of it. There's also the other side, historically speaking, of there have been movements like the Chipko Andolan, where people embraced trees and were ready to die to protect trees. They were ready to protect trees. There are also cases of especially certain trees which are considered sacred, people protecting them at the cost of their lives. So it's one thing to talk about what the theology is, but India is also, has India, if we consider in India, have we really seen environmental concerns being tangibly addressed because of somebody's religious or bhakti beliefs?
I think this has to be seen in a complete context. Undoubtedly, there have been instances of destruction, right? You mentioned a few, and I can mention a few more, like Indra unleashing torrents of rain, right, to try to destroy Braja and so on, the land, holy land of Krishna, Vrindavan. However, we will see that these are by and large rare instances. They're exceptional events. They're not the standard. Generally, when you hear about exceptional events in history, for example, let's say you were studying the history of a king. And, you know, you will say, suppose he was a very good king and people were happy and, you know, that he was very just and there was a lot of productivity and so on and so forth. You had a little mention of that. But if there were some wars and so on, you'll find a lot of description and discussion on those wars.
Okay.
But on the day-to-day life of the people, you know, because it's a kind of a day-to-day, everyday thing. It's just ordinary. So and there isn't much of a discussion there. Mm. So that's the first point, that we have to see these as exceptional events, number one. Second, even concerned with these exceptional events, why do they happen? There are lessons to be learned from that. Now, Indra was the king of the demigods. And he's supposed to be the protector and the benefactor of the human race. But here, it turns out that he was acting in exactly the opposite way. So the lesson to be learned is that however high and mighty one may be, it is the way of this world that power may corrupt one's mind and make one proud. And even someone who is a devotee of God may lose his good intelligence and act in shocking ways like Indra did. So in this example, what is to be learned is how fickle and fragile the situation of people is in this world, and how we should not act and how we should beware that even very elevated personalities can lose their intelligence. So that's one thing. Now, coming back to other examples like Hanuman and Hanuman burning down Lanka, etc. Of course, these are acts that are meant to show to the world the victory of dharma over adharma. You know, the victory of the righteous and the virtuous over the sinful and the demoniac. So violence is not completely prohibited in the Vedic scheme of things. Although the Vedas do talk so much about ahimsa, but there are situations in life where it becomes imperative to exercise violence. And that's why the whole battle of Kurukshetra happened, and Krishna was the one who basically orchestrated this whole thing. Regarding the kind of episodes that you mentioned, this is my response about the two categories of people who did that. But over and above that, the general way or conduct of life in the Vedic civilization was very much of a kind that was completely in harmony with nature. And that has continued and perpetuated over millennia and millennia. It was only in the last several centuries that there appeared to be some kind of a break or some kind of a deviation from this norm. Even till a few years ago, in villages in India, you would find such a sublime spirit, such a sublime sensitivity to the environment, such a beautiful culture of respect for the environment, such a high level of discipline and education and awareness about these things, that it might come as a complete surprise to us, because even we as educated, so-called educated people don't do that. For example, take a typical village. One devotee from Orissa was mentioning to me that in his village, even till recently, till a few decades ago, they would have many lakes or ponds. And these lakes and ponds were scrupulously preserved by the people of the village.
Hmm.
And there were different ponds that were earmarked for different purposes. There were ponds that were earmarked for, bathing. And you couldn't do anything else there except bathing. There were ponds that were earmarked for drinking water and wells. And you only could take drinking water from there. You couldn't wash your clothes there. You couldn't do anything there. Like that. So there were different lakes for different purposes, and everybody understood that. There was also enormous forest wealth. And there were different types of forests. And each type of forest had a certain purpose earmarked. Some forests were those where the animals and the birds were left alone. There were certain types of forests where the sages went in for meditation. There were certain types of forests, and these forests usually were those that were adjoining the villages, which would be used as sources of livelihood for the villagers. So it was not that they exploited forests like the way they people do today. It was done in a scale of moderation. It was done in a spirit of sensitivity. And it was done collectively with an understanding of what was needed for replacement and for sustenance of that particular forest. So there were there were forests, there were water bodies, there were animals. You know, all these were protected in different ways. So humanity, that is those living in the villages, did utilize the resources of the environment, but it was done in a very cultured way, in a very sustainable way, in a very sensitive way, in a very cooperative way. The entire village cooperated. You see, this was the level of education. I don't mean material education as we understand it today, but this was the level of refinement of the intelligence and the consciousness, even of people in the village who may not have known how to read and write. And this was there till a few centuries ago. And then what happened is that gradually there was colonization, and this particular culture was eroded. And it was sometimes willfully destroyed. And it came to be that laws were enacted in the British times to take away the rights to the forest from the village to the state. So earlier the villagers were managing their own affairs. They had wise elders. They were steeped in understanding. There were saintly people who used to come there, live there, travel, visit. So because of the refined spiritual understanding and their understanding of spiritual ecology, this thing was preserved for millennia. But the moment the government took away the rights of the villagers and their, shall we say, superintendence of their own resources in their neighborhood, gradually, with passage of time, the government started exploiting those resources for capitalistic purposes. So yes, I agree with the point that those people said earlier, that the rampant capitalism was also one very, very important cause, but it's a form of materialism anyway. So the government started coming in, giving contracts to timber contractors. The British wanted to cut a lot of wood to send back to the UK, and they wanted to do so many things, to build railway carriages, to do so many things. And gradually the villagers lost the incentive. They lost the opportunity. They lost that culture. They lost that mindset that it was they who were responsible for the upkeep of these forests and for the environment. Now it was the prerogative of the government. It was the duty of the government, because the government took away these rights in the first place. So villages generally were of that sort. And finally, after years and years and years of such, shall we say, disempowerment of the villages and the dismemberment of this kind of sublime ecological culture, which was based on spirituality and deep religion, what happened is that the villages started becoming dirty places. They started becoming places where the villagers remained uneducated. I don't mean, again, educated from the point of view of what we commonly understand it. But they lost that sense of ecology, the sense of relationships. They lost that sense of civility. They also became exploitative like everybody else. And then there were social problems, there were quarrels, the bitter quarrels amongst the people, the exploitation of nature. It all happened like that. That's why Mahatma Gandhi, if you look at it, Srila Prabhupada may have differed with him on certain theological issues. But when it came to economic organization and environmental protection, he very much appreciated Mahatma Gandhi's views, especially his idea of Swaraj. Swaraj means independence, but his definition of independence was self-restraint. Whereas the modern understanding of independence is freedom from restraint.
Oh, that's striking.
So in that sense, because the villages of yore in India practice the principle of simple living and high thinking. So today, the moment industrialization came in, mass production, mass consumption, consumerism, and all of that started to get encouraged with industrialization, technology, and so on, that sublime innocence, that beautiful culture of spiritual ecology of the villages was lost. So it's not that there weren't examples. There were examples. There was, over a period of the last few centuries, a gradual deterioration in that because of the factors that I just mentioned.
Thank you. That's quite a comprehensive overview. While you're talking, I just remembered that in the Mahabharata, when the Pandavas are in the forest, Vyasadeva comes to meet them and says that, you know, you have stayed here for a sufficient amount of time, and many sages come and to visit you also. You stay for too long over here, the flora and fauna here will get disrupted. You can move to another place now.
Yes.
So that is environmental sensitivity, we could say. And another point about self-sufficiency, that is I have been reading about Indian history, and I found that in some ways, before colonization, even when India was ruled by Islamic invaders, they didn't interfere so too much with the socio-economic systems. They did disrupt the religious structures, but the socio-economic structures were maintained in their own way. And as long as they got their tariffs, they got their taxes, they left people alone. And that was one of the reasons why India has been so resilient. Although the cities were visible manifestations of wealth and opulence, but it was the villages which were the sources of the wealth. And invaders came and plundered the cities, and that plunder was devastating, but the villages were not affected that much. And within a few years or a few decades, again, there was a resurgence because the villages were still prosperous, or rather they were the source of prosperity. And so self-sufficiency in terms of
local leaders managing things locally is something which actually keeps people more in tune with the ecology. You know, in some ways capitalism is blamed, but when you're talking about the government taking power, this is what happened in a very tragic way in China at the time of Mao Zedong's rule. There is something called the Great Leap Forward. And he wanted to show how China is prosperous. And he had the idea that all the grains from all over China will be centralized, brought to the central place and then allotted everywhere. And then, so there were people, they would grow land, grow grains, but they were not allowed to use them. And all the grains were taken for them. And they were kept in the granaries and stocked. So outside those granaries, people were starving and dying. And but those grains were not given. And everybody started inflating that we have got this many grains, we have got this many grains. Because none of them wanted to incur the wrath of the ruler. And eventually, millions of people perished in that famine, which came from too much centralization. So it's not just capitalism. In terms of political ideology, capitalism and communism differ substantially. But in terms of having a common denominator of materialism and exploitation of nature for the purposes of humanity, I think both of them are similar.
You know, that reminds me of a little joke. Of course, it's true. Both capitalism, communism, all these sorts of isms are basically just different words or different types of materialism. So there's this little quip, I forget who said it. He said, capitalism is the reverse of communism. In one, man exploits man. And in the other, it's the reverse.
Yeah. I think it is Winston Churchill. I heard about this.
Yeah. No, not to somebody else.
Oh, is it? Okay.
So essentially, the point is that you have to bring in your spiritual conception, your devotional conception into your thinking. The culture that is based on an understanding of our spiritual nature, an understanding of the existence of the Supreme Lord, an understanding that we are His servants and we have to be devoted to Him and carry out activities for His pleasure to achieve perfection in our life, to live a life of gratitude for what the Supreme Lord has given us to live in this world, which is our environment, and to deal with it with respect and with care, with love, with intelligence. That is the kind of culture that can make everything sustainable. Otherwise, environmentalism, devoid of this kind of a consciousness, will not sustain.
One of the prominent thinkers, not related to environmentalism, but overall sociological thinkers, is Max Weber. And he has a theory of the disenchantment of nature. That nature was in the past seen as infused with sacred, mysterious, subtle presences and powers. And we have disenchanted nature. And because of that, we have lost respect for it. So that idea that nature should be seen as mystical in some ways is, or rather not mystical in the sense of, mystical in the sense that we just can't indiscriminately interfere with the ecological balances. In fact, going back to the same point of communism, it is that the birds which would sometimes take the peck on the grains and the crops. So Mao Zedong labeled all the sparrows and other birds as capitalist birds. And he had all of them shot down. And eventually, that led to other predator, other forms of pests coming up, and something like China had to import about 500,000 sparrows from Russia afterward. So nature has its own balances, and there's a certain amount of we could say decentralization. You use the word disempowerment. So for eco-friendly culture to develop, there will need to be a certain amount of decentralization, isn't it? So now this would be, in many ways, the environmental movement or environmentalism is talking a lot about centralization. That they'll just say, at a central level, government will enact these policies, and then we will all become united because we are all concerned about the earth, which is our home. But that is not happening. It is actually, although environmental movement is becoming active, the opposition to it also is becoming active. And there are people who are called as climate change deniers. That's a derogatory label given to them. But they are saying that with respect to climate change, the skeptics of climate change, there they have threefold concerns, which in some ways I feel are valid. One is that when we consider things are how much of the climate change is actually caused by humans, how much of it is natural? Now, the earth itself, sometimes the temperatures rise and go down. So what we call as climate change, how much of it is natural and how much of it is human? Then second is, how destructive is it actually going to be? Because there were many doomsday prophecies about how the world would be by 2000, 2010, 2020. They're not happened. And third is that how much are your recommended measures actually going to correct things? So how much is it caused by humanity? How harmful are the effects? And how much are your recommended, how much can we change it or by doing what you're saying? So, and from what I have read, there is no doubt that the environment has changed. There is no doubt that humanity has caused it. But rather than a top-down approach where there is an attempt to politically enforce a macro restructuring of society, a more bottom-up approach where people are individually inspired to become more environmentally conscious, more spiritually conscious, that has a greater chance of working without making too much of a demand and evoking too much opposition. So probably now I think we are going toward the last part of what can be done about it and what our theology can contribute to that.
Yeah. You mentioned this example of Mao Zedong and all that he did, his ill-conceived plans and his ventures, about killing the sparrows and so on. In fact, it was so ghastly. I think it was called the four pests. There were sparrows, there were rats, there were some, I forget now.
Yeah, four capitalist prey, but yeah.
So there were four kinds of such entities. Yes. I think sparrows, there were three others.
Yeah, I also.
And they were so cruel. What they did was that not only did they shoot them, but what they did was that they galvanized not only the army, but the whole civilian population as well in the villages and everywhere. And they went around banging utensils with spoons wherever they saw sparrows. So they stood under trees where the sparrows would come and rest, and they did not let the sparrows alight on any surface. Then they flew and flew and flew and just died out of exhaustion. Many died like that. So herein lies a basic misunderstanding and ignorance of the fundamentals of ecology. That is why I was mentioning earlier that in the protection and conservation of the environment, an understanding of ecological principles is very important. And I don't mean just simple mundane ecology. That in itself is very vital. If Mao Zedong had at least understood even basic modern scientific ecology, he would have understood what kind of devastation it would cause just by destroying one type of species. So much of interdependence. But more and above the modern scientific ecology, which is very important, there is the higher sense of the ecology where we see the role of the Lord, of the Supreme Lord, of Krishna within it, and Krishna's scheme of things for the world, where every species has a right to survive and exist. Every species has a stake, has a claim to the resources of nature, proportionately. It is not only the prerogative of the human race. So these were the mistakes, the whole the paradigm problems with Mao Zedong's worldview. So that was one part. Coming to the other part of what you said was about rather than everything being centralized, it should be decentralized. Yes, that is exactly what I was saying earlier, that and also, yes, I agree with the point that during the rule of the Mughals and other such invaders, they didn't so substantially interfere with the socio-economic setup. They did, but not to that degree. But the Britishers, when they came, they completely overhauled the system. Yes? So, as I mentioned earlier, that they took away the entire prerogatives and the rights and the powers of the local communities from the resources that were traditionally for millennia at their disposal and which they looked after with wisdom and care and love. Once they took that away from them, then what happened is you alienated them, you disenfranchised them, you disempowered them, and then you made laws sitting in some capital city somewhere. And then you expected everybody down to every village to obey every law you made. And because it was a difficult thing now in this age of materialism where everyone was driven by selfish ambition, and because of the simultaneous lack of spiritual education and the rise of materialism, it was very difficult for the people in the village to buy in to everything the government was saying, and even what the environmentalists started saying of late. So, in as much as decentralization is important, it is not sufficient. And you also alluded to this point, that there has to be spiritual education. And there has to be a restoration of the spiritual culture in every village. Otherwise, it won't work. What will happen is that instead of some personalities, bureaucrats sitting somewhere, some politicians somewhere sitting at some distant place, you know, having their own vested interests in making some decisions or policies, you know, and very often they do it for their own private gain. Now, you will have people sitting at the local village level who will exploit. They will become the exploit level because they have the power, but they don't have that spiritual culture. They don't have that spiritual education. So in as much as an administrative decentralization is necessary, it is even more important to restore, to revive, to strengthen the spiritual culture by making people aware of the fundamental bhakti ecological principles or the spiritual ecological principles. So when one takes to the process of devotional service, And that's also another reason, coming back to the earlier point you had made about why we have seen so many mistakes in our culture, where even though we have this philosophy, but we have destroyed the environment. Partly because even if you are intellectually aware of these kind of spiritual principles, but we have not internalized it. We have not imbibed it. We have not realized it. And there isn't that kind of a support structure around us that facilitates the growth of that spirit, that spiritual spirit and that culture. So I think spiritual education and restoration of spiritual culture is a must. And automatically in the environmental conservation and protection will happen. You know, I was hearing a lecture just this afternoon. It's a conversation rather Srila Prabhupada was having with somebody in the Bhaktivedanta manor in the 70s sometime. And he was telling the guest that, you know, love is the principle, he said. You can do something with love or you can do something without love. When you do something with love, then the person you're trying to please is very much pleased. And relating, and therefore when you, because you love Krishna, when you see everything around you, it reminds you of Krishna. Therefore, because you love Krishna, everything connected to Krishna reminds you of him, and therefore you can see Krishna everywhere in this sense. So he gave the example of a parent seeing the toy or the slippers of the child. And a parent loves the child. Upon seeing the paraphernalia or the belongings of the child, immediately thinks about that child with affection. So similarly, just as the parent loves the child and therefore will automatically see the child in everything around, so to speak. So if we love Krishna, we will see the divinity in nature all around us. We will understand that this is Krishna's creation. Whose nature is it? It's Krishna's nature. And therefore we should protect it. We should conserve it. We should not destroy it. We should not harm it. And we should treat it with respect. And we will also develop the understanding that harming nature means disrespecting God. So for those of us who may be practicing devotees, but we may not have thought of it like that. You know, we may be chanting the Hare Krishna mantra and we may be doing so many acts of worship of the deities, but then we may go and needlessly cut trees and we may do so many other things that are not necessary to do. Another thing that comes to mind is that one time when some devotee asked Srila Prabhupada about how he could see Krishna everywhere, he gave the example of his own spectacles on the desk in front of him. And he asked the devotee, when you look at these spectacles, what do you see? Whom do you remember? He said, we remember you, Srila Prabhupada. Why? Because these are your spectacles. So similarly, when you look at nature, you remember Krishna. That is how you learn to see Krishna everywhere. It's not necessarily that you see Krishna's form. Because the devotee was asking, is it that you see Krishna's form, so many Krishnas everywhere in every atom? Is that how you see Krishna? He says, no. You see Krishna in the sense that you see the connection of everything with Krishna because this is all Krishna's property. So I'll extend that analogy a little more. Let's say that devotee, you know, brushed off the spectacles from the desk in a disrespectful manner. What would that mean? It would mean that he was disrespecting Srila Prabhupada. Correct? Because he was disrespecting not ill-treating something that was the property of Srila Prabhupada. So treating somebody's property badly means to treat that person disrespectfully. You know, let's say you go into somebody's house, you see his car parked there in the driveway, and so you go and kick the car and you smash the car, and then you go to meet the person. But because you there and mistreated the car, you've already indicated that, you know, you have treated the owner disrespectfully. See, if you did not know the connection, you did not know who owned the car, it was one thing. But all the more serious is the offense if you knew who owned the car and still you acted disrespectfully. So therefore, for devotees, it's all the more important that we treat nature respectfully in all her aspects. Nature, the water bodies, the forest, the trees, the plants, the animals, the birds, the insects, the hills, the rivers, you know, everything around us. Because we understand that treating nature disrespectfully means treating Krishna disrespectfully. And that is against the tenets of the bhakti cult. The love, the cult of devotion to the Lord. Therefore, the root is trying to love Krishna and understanding what it really means to love Krishna. Not just in terms of the physical acts of doing our sadhana, chanting our rounds and going through the motions of doing activities in the day of worship and so on and so forth, but also to internalize it by understanding that there is a world view that will come as a result of that love. Because if I love Krishna, as Prabhupada said, I will love everything connected to Krishna. And I will then see Krishna in everything. So when I see Krishna in the trees, why will I harm those trees? If I see Krishna in the rivers, why will I pollute the rivers? If I see Krishna in the air, understanding the air to be Krishna's energy, now why will I pollute the air? So basically, that is how I see bhakti ecology to be the real alternative to the activist environmentalism of today, which is left-oriented, as you rightly said. So we want to bring in, we are not left or right or this or that, but we are God-centered. Bhakti-centered. So we want to bring in a bhakti-centered, ecologically driven environmental consciousness.
Yes.
And actually see everything is holy. Everything is divine.
Yes, that's beautiful. While you're speaking, I remembered a few things. How Srila Prabhupada, while the Juhu temple was being constructed, there are some trees in the perimeter of where the temple was to be.
Yes.
And the government authority said, we'll have to cut the trees.
Yes.
And Prabhupada said, that's against our religion. And Prabhupada, the devotees had to do various things, but finally they insisted that the tree should be there. So,
yes.
And Prabhupada said specifically, tell them it's against our religion to cut trees. It's quite striking.
Yeah.
And when you're talking about... Yeah.
Krishna Balaram courtyard.
Sorry?
They all similarly with...
In the Krishna Balaram courtyard, yeah.
One temple in the courtyard, yes.
So I was thinking another thing is that we have Bhaktivinoda Thakur in Chaitanya Shikshamrita talks about these four levels, fear, desire, duty and love. So if we apply these four even to nature, many environmental activists are trying to get people galvanized at the levels of fear and desire, or maybe duty. It's a lot of fear. If you don't do this, this will happen, this will happen, this will happen. And they are dismayed. Why are you not recognizing that this is so dangerous? So, on the other hand, if we talk about desire, you say that, you have lived in the environment, you have to take care of your descendants. You know, instead of, there's a common environmental saying that we have not inherited the earth from our ancestors, we have borrowed it from our descendants. That means the way we have lived is that we have not left anything from our descendants. So in some way they try to create desire for concern for others or duty. But in general, just like when we talk about religion at these four levels, fear, desire and duty, often fear, desire and duty, these levels are not very sustainable. Because if I feel that there is, just because I'm doing something out of fear, as soon as I feel that the danger is not there, I'll stop doing it. But when there is love, then it will be much, then it has become sustainable. So now, so what you said is that if we develop love for Krishna, naturally we will develop love for nature. In one sense, there are two distinct applications of this. Those who are already devoted to Krishna, we need to see that Krishna is not just someone whom we worship through the chanting of our mantras, but we serve Krishna through the way we are environmentally conscious also. So that's for those who are already bhaktas. So that, but for those who are not, so is it easier to appreciate and love nature, or is it easier to appreciate and love the source of nature, love God or love Krishna? In one sense, there are many people who nowadays talk about the universe in a generic way. And they say that I pray to the universe. There is a whole category of prayers. I saw one book on Amazon. It's called Prayers for Atheists. So, so there is a British author who has said that since Friedrich Nietzsche in about 150 years ago, sociologists have been predicting the death of God. But it has not happened. Religion has had enormous staying power. And he says that his theory is that this is because religion serves some human emotional and psychological needs. So if we want atheism to spread, then we have to find out how atheism can serve those needs. And what they're saying is, we, instead of believing in some transcendental God for whose existence, according to them, there is no proof, he says, we can sanctify the universe. So pray to the universe. May the universe respond to your prayers. And the universe is reciprocal. The universe, so in one way, for some people, they feel, yes, the universe is what, it's real. I see that. Nature is what I see. So to develop concern for nature, is it necessary to develop concern for God? And would it not be easier to develop concern for nature because it is visible and essential, and we can see that we need it, but we don't see God. Many people don't feel the need for God. So do we need to go in one sense, I care for the environment, I respect the environment. Do I need to bring in God to care for the environment? It seems to be going like a long cut way.
Yeah. Our clear belief as devotees of Krishna is yes. It is necessary to believe in God to make our conservation of the environment sustainable and complete. So I have given the theological background to it. The theological paradigm based on which we have such a belief. Before I come to that, I'll just make a brief mention of these atheistic prayers that you mentioned. Humanity has been there before and done that. Worship of the universe or worship of nature even is not something new. In fact, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna speaks of five types of worshippers. Those who worship Krishna, you have the pure devotees, the Mahatmas. You have those who are mixed devotees. You have those who are worshippers of the demigods. You have those who are impersonalists, who believe the absolute truth to be impersonal. And finally, you have those who are worshippers of the universal form, Now, this fifth category is basically worshippers of nature, worshippers of the universe. Okay. So this is a kind of a pantheism.
Okay.
Pantheism is the belief in the universe itself being God. So you don't need a personality behind it. You don't need a supreme intelligence behind it. There's no controller behind it. But nature itself is God.
Ekatvena prutaktvena bahudha vishvatomukham. That verse you're referring to?
Yes.
I think 9-15. Okay, yeah. Vishvatomukham, the universe, yeah.
Refers to the universal form. So, so this is a kind of pantheism. So it's not a new viewpoint. It's been around for a long, long time.
Okay.
So that doesn't impress us very much because it doesn't have much substance. It lacks depth. It lacks any form of logical and certainly spiritual rigor. So to explain this point of why God, belief in God and faith and devotion in God is necessary to sustain our concern for the environment and its conservation and protection, I'll go back to the four points that you mentioned that Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, that our motives for working, for performing any action are, you know, first there is fear, there is sense of reward, and there is duty, and then love. Yes? So, you know how I would see it? This is, by the way, a very beautiful analysis. This is an analysis, a categorization that I love to quote on many occasions because it is so apt. I also see a correlation between this and the three modes of material nature and transcendence. Fear is a characteristic of the mode of ignorance. The reward and desire for material progress and accomplishments and enjoyment is a characteristic of the mode of passion. Performing things out of a sense of duty is a characteristic of the mode of goodness. Whereas love, if it is applied to the Supreme Lord, is a transcendental phenomenon that goes through modes of material nature. Here we are speaking of spiritual love, not ordinary mundane love. So, let's look at environmentalism or the approach to the environment from these four points of view. What is the tamasic viewpoint or the viewpoint for the mode of ignorance to the environment? That is essentially destructive, right? It's a demoniac kind of viewpoint. Asatyam, apratishtam, jagat ahur anishwaram. As Krishna says in the 16th chapter, that they say that this universe is asatyam, it's false. It is apratishtam, it has no foundation. Jagat ahur anishwaram, it doesn't have an ishwara or a controller. It happened by itself. You know, so the views of the atheists today are not necessarily new. They have been around for a long time in different forms. So this is a kind of a demonic view that is the cause of destruction in nature. If I remember right, in the very next verse in the Bhagavad Gita, say, etam drishtim avashtabdhya nashtatmano pabuddhayaha Karmanaha Kshayayo Jagato Hitaha. Right? That's the next verse, am I right?
Yes, 16:9.
So, basically in this verse, Krishna will say, Etam Drishtim, by this viewpoint, this worldview, what worldview? That there is no creator, there is no God, you know, there is no foundation, yes, to this whole world. You know, what comes? They are lost unto themselves. Nashta atmanaha. Okay, so the people who hold such viewpoints are first of all lost unto themselves. And they are less intelligent. Alpa buddhayaha. Prabhavat yugra karmanaha. And they engage in horrible acts. Ugra. terrible acts, ugra karmana, kshayayaha, which will lead to destruction, jagato ahita, to the which are for the jagat or for the world, ahita, which is unbeneficial.
Mm-hmm.
So all the environmental destruction that we see is ugra karma. That ugra karma comes, it is propelled by principally the mode of ignorance. Now, the three modes of nature are not watertight compartments. They flow into each other. They merge and mix with each other. And as Krishna himself says in the Bhagavad Gita, that the three modes don't exist in isolation. They exist in combinations with each other. So then you have the mixture of the mode of passion that wants to enjoy the resources of material nature for the selfish purpose. Now, this ugra karmana could be caused by a combination of the mode of ignorance and passion. When the mode of ignorance drives environmental destruction, it is wanton, it is irreparable, it is just mindless completely.
Mm.
Just like simply just blowing up something, simply just destroying something, you know, completely. The mode of ignorance, the passion, the rajaguna, the rajasic exploitation of the environment is a little better. Not much, but a little better. Because there is some semblance of sense there, because they know that if I do too much of this, then I'll suffer the results of my own misdeeds. So they will still cut the trees, they will still pollute the atmosphere. And in sattva, there is a kind of sense of duty. It is my duty to protect the environment. But we should also remember that sattva is not also truly selfless. In sattva also you have the desire to be free from misery, from the reactions of one's own karma.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore they perform religious activities to get rid of their previous sinful activities or whatever. Now for those people who may be atheistic but adopt a kind of a sattvic approach to environment, it's a kind of a strange combination. So on one hand they understand the need to maintain the harmony, etc. But they're not fully sattvic because they don't have that belief in God. You know, they don't have that sense of understanding the relationship and the place of man in nature. And man in nature in relationship with God. They don't have that. So they're not fully sattvic. So the environmentalism of the activists could be a combination of so many things. And if they have political agendas and they have many other things, that it further complicates matters. So therefore, these environmentalism that is prompted by the three modes of nature will never sustain, will be at worst completely self-destructive and at best short-lived. Because in this material world, as Krishna explains, no mode of nature lasts very long. The predominance of the modes is always rotating. Sometimes sattva predominates, sometimes rajas, sometimes tamas, and it goes up and down and up and down. Now, if sattva, which is the mode of sustenance, which is the mode of balancing, which is the mode of harmony, has to prevail with respect to the environment, if sattva has to become predominant, then we need the help of bhakti.
Okay.
Because sattva cannot prevail, sustain, unless there is strong bhakti. Because we see another mistake environmentalists make is they see sustenance or sustainability only in the physical environment. They do not see sustainability in social terms of relationships. They do not see sustainability in other terms, cultural terms. So for them, and for environmentalists, it is only a question of the physical environment. But the devotees of the Lord, that the transcendental viewpoint sees it as a complete whole. And if your fundamental underpinning, your fundamental paradigms and philosophical underpinnings are rooted in rajas and tamas and even ordinary sattva, it will not last. So therefore, even if theoretically, let us say, you bring about a state where you have environmental harmony, but you don't live a godly life, so you'll have social disharmony. You'll have dysfunctional relationships. You'll have cultural problems. So therefore, in order to sustain environmentalism, it has not only to ensure that it broadens its scope to not just physical environment, but to social, cultural, and other related areas. And it has to take shelter of a higher and a deeper inclusive understanding of creation as a whole, which means to bring in Krishna or God into the picture. And I come back to the point I made right in the beginning and also last time, that your environmentalism will be incomplete unless you bring in Father God. And Krishna is actually the perfect environmentalist. The topmost environmentalist is Krishna. And you see that in his pastimes in Vrindavan. So as devotees of Krishna, you know, automatically, or if not automatically, at least by deliberate action and thought, we should try to follow in Krishna's footsteps and try to see how Krishna acted with so much respect, so much love, you know, towards the entire environment of Raja, of Rajabhumi, whether it was Govardhan Hill, and according it the due respect and worship, whether it was protecting the sweet waters of the Yamuna from the poison of Kaliya, protecting the other lakes, whether it was protecting all the various trees and branches by offering them worship. There are so many verses in the Bhagavatam where Krishna glorifies the trees of Vrindavan.
Yeah.
And speak of Krishna protecting and loving the cows, and not just the cows, but also the deer, the peacocks, and all the other life forms there. So in Krishna's pastimes, in Krishna's actions, in his thoughts, in his personality, as manifest in Vrindavan, we see the complete transcendental environmentalist. So therefore, we have to follow in Krishna's footsteps in order to achieve that kind of sublime environmental scenario. Right?
Beautiful. There's one devotee who's written a paper on the same theme of Krishna as a Krishna as an environmental, as a ideal deity for eco-friendly living. And yes. He takes some amount of metaphorical license. So he says that especially representative of Krishna's capacity to purge the environment of disruptive elements is his Kaliya Leela.
Yes.
So Kaliya represents, in some ways, we could say market capitalism or communism or materialism. And it was so toxic that even the birds flying above were being killed by it. And then Krishna came and used his potency to subdue and then drive away Kaliya. And then Krishna restored the beauty and the harmony of the ecology of Vrindavan. So similarly, if Krishna comes and dances in our hearts, then the materialistic drives within us that make us do things that have toxic influences, they can be driven away. And I was also thinking that when you said about sattva and beyond that to transcendence, one thing which many environmentalists also are recognizing is that for people to actually give up consumerism, they need to find non-material enrichment. And if we don't bring in God, mere love of nature will not really give non-material enrichment, because nature is also material. So one way we could say why merely loving nature is not enough is that as long as we are in material consciousness, we will want material pleasure. And the nature of material cravings are that they go stronger and stronger. And right now, if I am in sattva guna and I am reflective, I may say, okay, I live in harmony with the environment. But as rajas and tamas start increasing, that my desires will overpower my good intentions. So right. If one loves Krishna and gets some higher taste in the practice of Krishna bhakti, then the craving that drives consumerism will subside. And that's how also we could say that just loving nature is not enough. Rather, when we love Krishna, then we will be able to act out our love for nature, act on our love for nature. Otherwise, we'll not be able to sustain it.
Your love for nature will become more meaningful, more concrete, more substantive, more happy when you love Krishna.
Yeah, that's true. I read one more. He's a bhakta scientist, bhakta researcher. He contrasts, when I mentioned earlier that India doesn't have much of a history of environmental protection or activism. So he has an interesting theory. He says that in India, there is the bhakti worldview and there's the Advaitic worldview. And the Advaitic worldview in some ways holds that this world is an illusion. And the most important thing we need to do is to transcend this illusion. Whereas the bhakti worldview holds that this world is also an arena for service. This world is also a manifestation of Krishna's energy. So if environmental consciousness is to be fostered in India, maybe the bhakti worldview would be more conducive for that than the Advaitic worldview. And if you consider worldviews, there is this world and there is the other world, that is the spiritual world. Now, one of the defining differences between modern and pre-modern times is that in the pre-modern times, almost everyone in whichever part of the world they lived, they understood that there is some other world. And that is life's ultimate destination. Whether Christians had their heaven, Muslims had their Jannat, and Native Americans and Native Australians, they also had some understanding of another world. And this world is like a place of trial and travel. We have to live through it. So now the scientific revolution and the subsequent evolution of human thought led to the rejection of the other world as a mythology. And then through technology, we got the hope or the dream that we could make this world into paradise itself. So we don't need any other world. We will just make this world into paradise. So now in the attempt to make this world into a paradise, we have in some way started making it into hell, because our efforts are backfiring. And if we consider like a four quadrant diagram, you know, this we have this world, the importance of this world on the x-axis, and the importance of the other world on the y-axis. So if somebody says neither this world matters nor the other world matters, then they are basically nihilistic. They can't do anything. Then we have the materialists, and within that we have communists, capitalists, and to some extent we have even environmentalists. They say this world matters, but the other world doesn't matter. Or the other world doesn't exist, it doesn't matter, whatever. Then we have the Advaitins,
that the other world matters, but this world doesn't matter. And then we have the bhaktas, that this world matters and the other world matters also. So in some ways, those who say this world matters but other world doesn't matter, their own desires eventually will not let them take care of the world, especially because now that we have the power to control the world, or at least we think we have through technology. So to have power and then to not use power requires far go a greater self-control than to not have power at all. So when people throughout history had some level of materialism within them, but when there was no technology, we really felt that nature is much more powerful than us. We can't do much about it. Mm-hmm. Now through technology, when we think that, yeah, maybe we can subdue nature. So then to not do that without having any higher purpose is not going to be very easy. So in that sense, the bhakti worldview, which acknowledges the importance of this world while also giving due importance to the other world and giving us access to happiness streaming down from that level, that is the best way to actually sustainably take care of this world.
Yeah. Actually, as we discussed in the earlier part of our chat, that till a few centuries ago, the culture of spiritual ecology was very much prevalent and pervasive, even in Indian villages. So that culture was there, so there was no need for any kind of environmental activism, because the environment was being automatically looked after. However, then there came a time when there was degradation happening. And for a while, you know, there may have been intermittently here and there localized cases of activism we're not aware of. But in the last century, in the last few decades, we've had several such people coming up. You mentioned one in the beginning, the Chipko movement of Sundar Lal Bahuguna. And there have been several like that. There have been many, many instances of people now really campaigning for maintaining the purity of the river Yamuna, or protesting against the destruction of the hills in Brajabhumi for mining and so on and so forth. So against for the cleaning of the river Ganga, and you know, so there's a lot of activism going on. It could be more. It could be more, definitely. We should have more. But as I said, unless there is a proper spiritual education, it's a humongous task. It's an uphill task. Because you've taken away, you disempowered the villages and the common person. And you left him without the spiritual culture because of the materialistic and Western style of educational system that you introduced. You took away his spiritual culture, you took away his powers, and you centralized it. And now he has neither faith nor any understanding of spiritual knowledge, nor is he doing his spiritual practices significantly. And even if he's religious, it's just a mechanical kind of a ritualistic type of a religion. And there are many people with some deep faith, certainly. But in a large number of people, that substance is lacking. That understanding of the spiritual ecology is lacking. And because now everything is becoming so materialistic, and the government and the NGOs and so on, they try their best to rectify matters, but they're still going to release their sewage into the river. They're still going to throw rubbish somewhere else, you know. So this happens, you know, because of the lack of spiritual education.
Mm-hmm.
But coming to the issue of the other world and this world, yes, certainly. The idea of the quadrant is an interesting way of putting it, of the four quadrants and the two axes. And bhakti is best placed because we are concerned about both worlds.
Mm.
Sometimes, however, we see that it is the devotees who are a little callous when it comes to environment.
Yeah.
And such things. And the Advaitins are more sensitive and concerned, and they are the ones who are out in the forefront doing it. And we as devotees many times are shy of doing it, saying, you know, that's, well, you just better chant, better sit and chant, and, you know, do, why get into all these other things? So curiously enough, we have a kind of an ironical situation or a paradoxical situation where those who give a lot of importance to the other world but not to this world seem to be doing more for this world in terms of the environment than those who claim to give importance to both. So which means probably that it is time for us as devotees to also step up. You know, of course, a lot of devotees have done a lot. If you look at Govardhan Hill, you see they've planted trees all around Govardhan Hill. You know, they've done a lot of work. So a lot of NGOs, a lot of faithful devotees, you know, from different places, and, you know, have done so much work. So we must appreciate that. At the same time, I think we need to make it more mainstream, this kind of an approach and this kind of a consciousness. And let devotees also internalize this as something as critical to their spiritual life as, let's say, you know, going for darshan of the deities or something like that. So I think we must have this kind of a worldview that has to be encouraged. I think it's because the reason for devotees not having been so active in this is that perhaps they've not seen it like that. They've not been accustomed to thinking like that. This kind of a worldview, a holistic kind of a worldview, you know, are probably a kind of a, shall we say, detachment, you know. Because I do remember when I was in Vrindavan, and there was a whole movement going on to save the Yamuna. As you know, it's a great tragedy. Yeah. The Yamuna is diverted before she reaches Delhi and diverted into agricultural fields for growing rice, which is exported. It is diverted into industries in Delhi and surrounding places. And you don't have anything left of the Yamuna as she flows after Delhi, except the sewage and the industrial effluents that are then emptied out into the Yamuna. And what we get in Vrindavan is not real Yamuna water, except in the rainy season when the dams release some water. So that is a great tragedy, actually. So when many organizations were trying to get together to do something about this, you know, many of our devotees were reluctant, saying, you know, why should we get into all that? We have to chant our rounds, we have to, you see. So because devotees have not understood, they have not internalized the larger scope of Krishna consciousness. Today we are able to enjoy Vrindavan because somebody else did it for us. They built a temple for us. They preserved the holy dhams for us. You know, and as you rightly said, we borrowed it from our descendants. The environment is something we have borrowed from our descendants, not necessarily inherited from our ancestors. So we have a responsibility. We have a sense of duty to seeing that the various elements of the spiritual and devotional heritage that we have inherited are preserved and strengthened so that posterity can also avail of the benefits of these elements. Whether it's the Yamuna, it's the Ganga, it's the ghats of Vrindavan, the hills of Vrindavan, the pasturing lands of Vrindavan, or any other holy place or any other element of nature even. Yes, so therefore, I think we need as devotees to expand the scope of our thinking and not just keep it narrowed down to just doing our rounds and just, and that's it. That, of course, is the foundation. That's the fountainhead of all our spiritual convictions and activities. if we don't chant our rounds, if we don't hear the Srimad Bhagavatam, if we don't worship the deity with faith and love, then we will not have the right consciousness anyway. So then we will not be able to see the sublimity and the divinity in nature all around us. So we have to have the overall conception, you know.
That's true.
Of transcendent ecology.
Yeah, that's true. So, are there something which you could recommend what devotees could do? Because at one level, most of our movement is present in the cities.
Yes.
And even at the time of Krishna, there were cities. Vrindavan was a village, Mathura was a city. So I don't think urbanization itself is the problem. Based on our last time's discussion, I was re-articulating it that, you know, meat eating may have been going on throughout human history, but with the industrialization of meat eating, of the meat manufacturing factory, we could say, you know, that the scale, three things, the scale, the cruelty, and the recklessness, the dangerousness, like that has been unprecedented. So maybe in some way, urbanization itself is not the problem, but maybe the scale, the cruelty toward the nature and the recklessness or the dangerousness, that could be a problem. So what could, as a individual bhakti practitioner, do to become more environmentally conscious?
Mm-hmm. While it is true that urban settlements did exist in the Vedic times and earlier, we had Dwarka, we had Ayodhya, we had Hastinapur, yes, Indraprastha.
Yeah.
There. But those were eras when the opulences presented by nature were profuse. And these urban settlements were well spread out over large areas and probably didn't have the kind of congestion that we see today. And the people also didn't have the kind of consciousness that people of today have. So whilst I grant that urban areas have existed in the past, I would say that urbanization as it exists today has inherently some problem. That is the way I see it. Because it has become so infected, so to speak, with the modes of passion and ignorance, that it is very hard for anyone living in the cities to cultivate the mode of goodness and to rise to the spiritual platform and grow on the path of bhakti or any such spiritual activity. So to develop such a pure consciousness or even an environmental consciousness in the kind of cities that we have is going to be very difficult. It is not easy. So urbanization at its core, as let us say a strategy, as a policy instrument, has to be rethought. Today, the predominant economic philosophy is that we must have more urbanization. We must move the people from the village and from agriculture towards urban areas. And this is a viewpoint that is articulated by mainstream economists regularly, everywhere. So they basically want to intensify urbanization. So therefore, the urbanization as it exists today, there is a problem here. It's a topic that will take a long time to discuss. Maybe we won't talk about it in detail now. So, but therefore, what I think we really need is to preserve also the rural areas properly. and not to let the urbanization grow the way it is growing. And we see in the example of the current COVID-19 pandemic, now in India, just today or yesterday, I think they released a list of the hotspots. Okay, certain number of places which are hotspots and where the lockdown has to continue. And there are certain areas which are green areas where they will probably relax the lockdown significantly. It's interesting that all the urban areas, the major metros, are red zones. Why so? Because they are so congested. And even look at a place like New York. If you think that is this is India, fine. But what about New York? What about London? What about so many other urban areas which are facing problems? So urbanization has problems. And that is well acknowledged. It's not, it's something new. Sociological problems, cultural problems, and a host of other types of problems. But still, economists and a variety of other thinkers today seem to believe that this is the way forward. So at least first of all, to answer your question, I would say we need to recognize the severe problems associated with rampant urbanization, mindless urbanization, number one. Number two, that also means that we must realize the importance of the villages, of the rural areas, and we must preserve them. At least intellectually and with our heart, we should be convinced of this. Without which, you know, it's going to be more difficult. It will be just a token environmentalism. Just growing a few plants in your home and flower pots on your terrace and just having a few vegetables that you grow there. And okay, fine, very good. But it has to go deeper than that, right? Then further, what we should do is to maybe follow those five guidelines that I mentioned last time, those five criteria. You know, when we spoke of veganism, those five things that we spoke about yesterday, the other day, when we were discussing veganism, they were essentially one, that what we utilize from nature, from the environment, or from anywhere, has to be, I'll repeat that just to refresh memory and for the benefit of those who maybe didn't see that discussion. Number one, that it must be scripturally recommended or at least permitted.
At least not opposed.
At least not prohibited.
Prohibited, yeah.
Okay. Second is that we must cause no harm, yes, and not disrespect. Yes, to anything and everyone, anything and everything that we use. Cause no harm and offer no disrespect. So here I include, you know, human beings, I include animals, plants, rivers, mountains, oceans, lakes, you know, everything, the air. Okay. Third, utilize it in a mood of devotion to God. The process of obtaining it has to be done without causing harm, respectfully, and the utilization has to be done with devotion, understanding that these are all gifts of nature. Understanding, to quote one of the sentences of Prabhupada from his purports, one of my favorite lines, that human prosperity flourishes by the gifts of nature and not by gigantic industrial enterprises. Right? So recognizing that actually our happiness, our prosperity, our longevity, our success, you know, all depends on the gifts of nature. We must realize that we must use them not only without causing harm to them, but we must love. It must be done with love. The cows must milk with love. The crops must be sown and harvested and utilized with love. And ultimately, they must be offered to Krishna with love. That was the fifth. And the fourth element was use in moderation. Whatever you use, use it moderately. Don't overconsume. So this moderation point is there to counter or to take care of this consumerist mentality. So, and the last one, offer to Krishna with love. So obviously you can't use anything which you can't offer to Krishna and which is not scripturally authorized. So therefore, in terms of what we can do and what we can't do, number one, let us avoid using anything that is not scripturally authorized. Therefore, that means give up alcohol, give up meat, give up gambling, give up illicit sexual activity, give up this, give up that, right? All of these things. Second of all, it also means that whenever we utilize everything, anything, be conscious now that you don't cause any cruelty to it. The other day I was just reading the news and there was some article about some young man in India, one of the cities, who was arrested, or a group of young men, because they whirled around a puppy and they smashed him to death, the puppy. And such cruelty coming up because they just have no conception of any compassion or some refinement of the intellect. It doesn't exist. So we must be very careful to not act in a cruel way towards animals, towards plants and trees and the air, towards the soil, etc., etc. Even in our neighborhood here where I live, people were cutting down a tree and the branches also. And the reason for that is because the tree was shedding leaves and those leaves were falling into their building premises. And it was a big headache for them to clean those leaves every time. So just imagine, they were cutting trees and cutting off branches because they didn't want the leaves to fall in, because they didn't want to do the task of cleaning up, So we have to be very kind, and we can't be disrespectful and can't offer cruelty to anything and anyone. So it's a question of cultivating this mindset wherever we are. And the item of moderation means that we should not succumb to the consumerist propaganda. Today, modern economics thinks that prosperity and success comes or is measured in terms of how much you consume and how much you own. Whereas the Vedic viewpoint is that prosperity and success and happiness is measured in terms of how little you own and how simply you live. So the modern urban lifestyle, the modern materialistic lifestyle is oriented towards flashy living, opulent living, overconsumption. Whereas the Vedic lifestyle is oriented towards simple living, consuming as little as possible, as much only as is required, not flaunting one's wealth. But if excess wealth arrives by destiny or by the mercy of the Lord, we share it with others, use it in benevolent ways, especially in devotion to Lord Krishna. So therefore, in terms of consumption, we have to be very careful. We don't unnecessarily accumulate goods. The acquisitive spirit, the accumulative tendency, has also to be reined in and has to be controlled. That's very important. We must not succumb to our desires to accumulate more and more goods when we go into the city marketplace, into the shopping centers. Yes, and this is again one of the problems of organization. They just simply pour fuel into our dormant desires for acquiring more and more. So because these shopping malls and these roadside shops, the way they are decorated and the goods are displayed in such a tantalizing manner, and the way the advertising is done, and the way the whole social kind of mindset is, the social fashions and what's cool to do and what is desirable. So it just induces everybody to consume more and more and more. So there's no question of any environmental friendly living if one is of this mentality. So one has to guard very much against this consumerist mentality. One has to try to believe in the principles of simple living and high thinking. Simple living refers to reducing your needs, your wants. There's a difference between wants and needs. Living simply, minimize the number of clothes you need, just as much as you really need. Your paraphernalia at home, don't just accumulate more and more. There's this little thing that I keep saying when people ask how much is enough, you know, how much is enough to accumulate in terms of goods that we have. And I don't know whether I mentioned it in the discussion last time, but anyway, because it's relevant to the question you ask, I'll just say it again, and it's practical, that if the desire arises in our mind to acquire a certain good, a certain item, we should ask ourselves the question, is it necessary? Is it required? If the answer is no, that ends the matter. If the answer is yes, ask yourself a second question. Do I really need this item? If the answer is no, fine, matter ends there. If it's yes, ask yourself a third question. Do I really, really need this item? If the answer is still a yes, then okay, go ahead and buy it. Provided you also fulfill the other four criteria. That the item that you desire to obtain is not something that is prohibited by the scriptures, that it is, that you've not obtained it by any violence or cruelty or disrespect. Yes? And also that you utilize that item lovingly when you obtain it, and before you use it, that you offer it to the Supreme Lord. So that's another tip, that we have to reduce the consumption patterns that we have and reduce the wastage. Vedic culture essentially was one where there was no waste. Today, our consumption patterns are of such a nature that high consumption means high wastage.
Yeah.
Therefore, one of the means of judging economic advancement and prosperity in economics is the garbage disposal index. The more the garbage that you've disposed, the more prosperous you are as a society.
Oh, okay.
Whereas
that's the quite a tamasic way of looking at it.
Yes, the Vedic culture was that. The Vedic culture was, you know, first of all, there's nothing called waste. It's all something that is a part of a recycling process. So whether it's paper, paper or cloth or wood or utensils and metals and so on, you know, it could be recycled. It could be reused. Right? And then the other things like, all right, yes, try to use items that are organic. Try to have your little rooftop or your veranda, little garden, and so on and so forth. Support activities and ventures that are of this sort, especially, you know, those types of communities and projects that try to establish self-sufficiency. So these are some of the tips that I would say. It's a combination of mindset plus practical actions to do. There are many more, but I'm just giving some of them right now.
Thank you, Maharaj. Yeah, I think within urbanization also, we all can make it less toxic by adopting various practical measures. And
yes,
maybe you can conclude by speaking a little bit about, you mentioned about projects for eco-friendly living. And you have pioneered a project, Gokuldham, near Belgaum. Would you like to speak a little bit about that project and your vision, okay, how it is coming up?
Right, Gokuldham, it's envisioned as a self-sufficient Vedic eco-village project, a self-sufficiency farm project, being inspired by the teachings of Srila Prabhupada. And the idea is to have a community of devotees that lives there following the principles of simple living and high thinking. So it's work in progress. We have a long way to go before we can attain the target of self-sufficiency in all respects, or at least in most respects. So our devotees are living a very simple life there. It's about 40 kilometers from the place where I stay, the city where I stay, the town, Belgaum, in the state of Karnataka in India. And the devotees there don't use electricity.
I think that is, among all the projects in our movement, this is among the few, if not the only one, where we are avoiding electricity, isn't it?
Yes, maybe not the only one. There are, I'm sure, a couple that also don't use electricity.
But that's rare.
It's rare, yes. But we are a little more rigid when it comes to trying to live simply. So we try to not use plastic, although to some degree, sometimes it's unavoidable. But our attempt is to find substitutes in course of time. So eliminate all the products of the modern industrial civilization. You know, so industrial, we try our best to avoid using industrial materials, industrial products, and so on. No chemicals, certainly. No chemical fertilizers and pesticides and so on. We also don't use, naturally, no petrol and diesel. Although we do travel to the project in vehicles that use petrol and diesel. But within the project, we don't use that. We use natural sources of energy, including for cooking, for water lifting, and water transportation, and such like, for lighting also. We try to grow our own food. We haven't attained full success yet. Vegetables, we're almost quite there. But grains, it will take a while. We're struggling with water, self-sufficiency. So once we have that, then we will go on to this. So that's the kind of life, very simple life, very rustic. With how even the housing materials are basically non-chemical, non-industrial, no cement, steel, plastic used in the construction of the housing shelters. We have a small little temple there, which is within the ashram. Altar is also made of stone and mud and limestone, and so on. So we have cow, and they graze. So that's a little description of this Gokuldham project.
I have been there, and I could see the devotees there are very inspired. Many of them are using their engineers by background. They're using the engineering to come up creative solutions for local generation or local production of things. And it seems that it has created a significant awareness, at least in the nearby areas of Maharashtra and Karnataka, where people come to visit and see that whether such a project is actually possible. They are quite amazed to see people choosing to live like this voluntarily, because most people, as the trend is, want to leave the as I consider primitive villages and go to cities. But to see young, educated, intelligent people voluntarily choosing to live lives of simplicity and spirituality, it speaks volumes for many people and makes them rethink their priorities in life. So apart from specifically what is achieved over there, just having a model of like that has ripple effects in society also.
Yes. You know, we don't expect that everybody will live like the way the devotees live there. We know there's not a practical or a realistic expectation. But what we want to do is to be like a beacon light for the world, to send out a message to the world that you don't really need all the things you think you need to be happy in your life and to be prosperous. We want to get people to think about what real happiness is and what are the sources of happiness. We want to redefine prosperity and success. And we also want to make people experience a little bit of that joy that comes in living in such a sattvic atmosphere, where there is, which is based on devotion to Krishna and simple living. Long way to go, but nevertheless, it's the beginning.
See, it has come a long way also. It's a long way to go, but it has come a long way since started. Yes.
And I hope that they can, more and more devotees and others also feel inspired to establish such projects and work seriously on that. But it needs a lot of commitment.
Yeah.
It needs also a very clear vision about what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Maharaj.
So environmentalism is happening naturally there because we're learning more and more about how the ecological balances happen. You know, living on the land is itself a massive learning experience. One understands how that local ecosystem functions. And then one has to blend into that rather than superimposing our conceptions there, which to some degree is happening even in our case, because here we have sort of intruded into nature, into spaces that were probably earlier being taken up by animals and so on. So to some degree, we are also guilty of that intrusion. But we hope it is not to a very significant degree. And we hope that by this, we can create a prototype or a kind of an example that will be inspiring to the world.
Yes, Maharaj. We are walking your talk in this specific sense by pioneering a project. And so if devotees want to know more about the Gokuldham project, is there a website where they can visit, or is it on the ISKCON Belgaum website? Or?
Well, a little bit. But I have consciously not promoted it in a big way.
Okay.
For the simple reason that, you know, we have a few devotees there, a small team, and there is a lot of work to be done there.
Okay.
So we want to have at least develop the basic infrastructure like water and a few things like that and food and make arrangements by the time we are ready to receive more and more guests. We already have many guests coming in. Professors bring their students, environmentalists come in groups, and you know, school children come in with their teachers, and general people who are curious to know what we're doing, they come in. Our devotees from Belgaum and from other cities, they come to see. So we do have a lot of guests anyway, but I think we'll wait till we have set up our infrastructural situation there in a better way, at least water especially.
Okay.
Water and food and some further living facilities.
Yes, that is true. Yes, Maharaj. I think Prabhupada, when you are establishing Mayapur also,
find they should not expect to find very wonderful you know, cottages and things like that. It's very simple. It's beautiful, but it's also very, very simple.
Yes, Maharaji. We've covered a lot of territory, but I just briefly try to summarize. So we started with the origin of environmentalism, that all, in some ways it is because of anthropocentrism coming from Christianity. In many ways, it is also materialism coming from rejection of God and the belief that technology gives us the power to do whatever we want in nature.
Yes.
And through industrialization, that became very strong. And we differentiate between environmentalism, which is a leftist political activist movement with genuine concerns, but also embroiled with politics, whereas ecology or ecological concern or ecosystem, that will be much more localized and it can organically.
Can I interrupt for one moment?
Yeah.
I wouldn't say that all forms of environmentalism or environmental activism are leftist in nature. Some of them certainly are.
Okay.
But if you look at the example of Sundarlal Bahuguna and the Chipko movement,
yeah,
his environmental activism was based on his spiritual beliefs.
Yes, of course, yeah.
Mr. Agarwal, who was campaigning for Mother Ganga, so his activism was also based on spiritual beliefs.
Yes, that's true.
The Western models of environmentalism are based on the left-wing kind of approach.
Yeah. Okay.
Indian activists, the homegrown Indian activists, I'm not speaking about those Indian activists who are influenced by the Western approaches. Homegrown, environmental activists of the kind I've mentioned, they're not left of center.
Yes. Thank you for clarifying that. Then we discussed about, what the problem is more or less well known. The ideological cause of the problem and the practical solution, what could be done. So in that, you discussed that when we may want to take care of nature, but just the attempt to do that is not likely to work because the exploitative mentality will come in. You talk about fear, desire, duty, love. And then you mentioned that when we bring God, then the environmental activism becomes sustainable. So these are associated with three modes. And we get non-material enrichment through the practice of bhakti, which can free us from the consumerist mentality, which is the cause of environmental problems. And then in philosophically speaking, bhaktas care for both this world and the other world. But practically, we might have a more insular attitude where we're not so socially engaged. And Advaitins who don't care, who consider the world to be illusion, actually may care for it more. So we need to become more aware of what bhakti means. And when we care for Krishna, it's like if we respect Srila Prabhupada, respect his spectacles, his glasses. So similarly, we care for Krishna, we need to care for his nature also. And then as far as what could be done at a individual by devotees, we talked about those principles. Even if we are living in an urbanized setting, we recognize the importance of villages and try to preserve it as much as possible. And by living in the urbanized settings, we make it as less toxic as possible by doing what is, I try to create a rhyme or a sanction, then sanction, compassion, moderation, devotion. There's one more you mentioned, five factors.
Love.
Okay.
Devotion, that is offering with devotion, but when you try to...
Okay, working with love.
No,
yes.
No cruelty.
That was compassion.
And then with love and devotion.
Okay. So use with love and devotion and offer in devotion.
Yes.
The two different things. Right. Okay. So that way we could, within our particular places, we can become more environmentally conscious. And of course, there are devotees who are trying to do this and they can be supported in whatever way is possible. So we as actually bhakti theology has a way to can provide philosophical foundation for grounding environmental concerns in a holistic worldview. And if that opportunity is tapped, then bhakti can actually do a lot of good, not just for the environment, but for reawakening spiritual consciousness in the world through environmental consciousness.
Yes, very nice. I think we could summarize it in two words, bhakti ecology.
Bhakti ecology, yes, Maharaj.
Because ecology deals with the relationships of living entities amongst themselves and with the inanimate world. And bhakti understands the conception of the relationship with God and sees the creation with respect to God and with each other. So that gives a deeper perspective. So we just don't want to be environmentalists. We just don't want to be only plain ecologists. But our approach is a bhakti ecology.
Yes.
Something like that. So I guess that will be something very wholesome, very holistic.
Thank you very much for your time and for joining. This is always illuminating to have your association.
Yeah. So thank you very much. And I hope we'll meet again soon.
Yes, I look forward to that. We'll all look forward to that. We and our viewers.